It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour we look at human trafficking. It's a crime affecting more than 300,000 adolescent girls that are lured annually into the U.S. sex industry, many of them from right here in the Midwest. This hour we want to learn how that trafficking works, how young women are ensnared and used, and about efforts to combat trafficking. Also, we want to learn how to identify trafficking when you see it and what we can do about it. Next Monday and Tuesday, the Chrysalis Foundation of Des Moines is hosting public events to raise awareness about human trafficking. The event is called In Our Own Backyard, Human Trafficking in Iowa. In just a moment, we'll be talking with the executive director of the Chrysalis Foundation and also the founder of Teens Against Human Trafficking about that event. But first of all, let's talk with a survivor of trafficking. Beth Jacobs is joining us from Arizona. Beth now runs an NGO in Arizona called the Willow Way that supports and empowers victims of prostitution and sex trafficking. But in the 1980s, she was trafficked for sex for 6 years. Beth Jacobs, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you for joining us and for sharing your story so that we can learn how this happens to young women. Please tell us your story. How did it start?
Well, I want you to know that nobody raises their hand and says, you know, hey, I'd like to be a prostitute today. What a great career choice. I mean, it doesn't happen that way. The way it happened to me is I was 16, and I was my parents were getting divorced. I came from a little small town of 1,200 people in northern Minnesota, and I moved to a suburb of Minneapolis with my father. And I was looking for a job. They had a bus system, and we didn't have a bus system where I came from. And so I took the bus to look for a job, and I found out that I could get into a bar downtown Minneapolis, and I could shoot pool, and it was fun, and it gave me something to do. And I had a good time doing that, and they never carded me. They acted like that was just okay. Well, I went on the weekend. A job actually called me for an interview, so I went downtown, did the interview, and then I went to the bar. Well, I missed the bus. I didn't realize the bus didn't come the same time on the weekend. So the first night I missed the bus, I called my father, and he came and got me. The second, then the next day, I went back downtown, and I went to that bar, and I actually missed the bus again. And that time I didn't call my dad because I didn't want to. I knew he had to work the next day, and I didn't want him to come and get me. So I went back in to try to find a ride home. And there was a guy that I knew briefly. He had a friend that I knew a little bit better. I had been to a barbecue at his house the week before, and everything was fine. I mean, I went to the barbecue, met him, his kids, and had a good time, and went home. And I would say if everything was fine. The guy in the bar, his friend, said, well, I know where Miko is. His name was Miko. He said, he might give you a ride. So we acted like he called Miko and said, yeah, he said, come to this party and meet him and he'll give you a ride home. So I went with him. I asked him where it was. He said, Chicago. I didn't pay that close attention to geography when I was in high school. So I asked him how long it took. He said, 2 hours. And I said, okay, well, you know, I'll do that. I didn't want to, but it was my only way home. So I went with him. And he asked me if I wanted a drink. He had a McDonald's cup. And I drank some of the drink, and I don't remember anything. I remember him waking me up, and it was dark out.
So there was a drug in that drink that had you black out.
I'm pretty sure, yeah, because there's no way I would have. It was only one drink. I wouldn't have fell asleep. It was in the middle of the day. It was like about 6:30. I think we left about 6:30, maybe 6:45 at night. Mm-hmm. And it stayed light out till 10 o'clock. So, you know, 2 hours would have been 8:30. So I knew it had to be after 10 o'clock.
So where were you taken, Beth?
I was taken to a truck stop. I'm not sure where it was. It was somewhere between Minnesota and Chicago. I'm not exactly sure where it was.
And what happened there?
And then he was waking me up, and I asked him, I said, well, where are we? And he said, well, he said, we're not in Chicago yet. He said, we ran out of money. He said, do you know what I am, baby? And I said, no. And he said, I'm a pimp. And I kind of laughed at him. And he said, no, you're going to be my prostitute. And he said, we need money to get to Chicago. And you're going to get in this truck and sleep with this man. And he's going to give you money or give me money. So I laughed at him. And I said, well, I'm not that kind of girl. You know, I'm sorry, but I'm I can't do that. And but he was serious. So I tried to get out of the truck, and I leaned over to open the door, and he started to hit me with something hard. He had a gun, so he beat me with this gun. I was afraid he was going to kill me. And the truck driver actually got out and helped him put me in the truck. And then he hopped up in the truck and he raped me. And from there, when he was done, he pushed me out of the truck and threw me into the car and told the man he wanted his money back because I cried too much because I was upset and scared. And anyway, he beat me some more and told me if I ever lost him any money again, he would kill me and my family. And I didn't know for sure if he knew where my dad lived or not, because he knew my friend, and I talked about my dad. I talked about my family, so he could have known, you know.
Yeah.
And they hurt me, so why wouldn't they hurt my family?
So Beth, I'm so sorry this happened to you. It's an incredibly painful story, and this is just the beginning of it. Because of our time, I want to ask you how it happened that you were taken and became trafficked for a longer period over 6 years. What happened to put you in that longer term situation?
Well, because when you get there, I mean, I was raped a million times. They kept me in a room. You know, your self-esteem, they beat you up not only physically but mentally. They tell you nobody would want to. And, you know, I grew up in a Christian home, and prostitutes were looked down on, and I did feel like nobody wanted me. So,
were your parents looking for you?
Yes. Yeah, my dad was looking for me.
Mm-hmm. They never found you?
Nope, he couldn't find me. He even went downtown into bars. He went because he knew I mentioned that I was shooting pool. So he even went into bars.
Uh-huh. And you were afraid to reach out to them because there had been threats made against your family. And based on the abuse that you were getting, you had every reason to believe that those threats would be carried out.
Well, I had no opportunity to reach out to anybody. I mean, they kept me in a room. There was no phone there. I couldn't leave the room.
Did you make any attempts to escape?
Yes. Yes, I did try to escape. I got away once, and I went to the police, and the police brought me to the train station to wait for the bus. So I wasn't even at the bus station. They brought me to the bus station right before the bus left, put me on the bus, and I rode the bus almost. I almost made it to Minnesota. I had to use the bathroom, though, so I got off in Wisconsin to use the bathroom. And when I came out of the bathroom, the pimp was there. So how did he get there? You know, it makes you wonder. He said my mother sold me to him, but I'm pretty sure the police told him there must have been a bad police in that unit, and he told him where I was. He had to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they took me back to Chicago. And I thought they would kill me that time. I really did. I was afraid. And so after that, I didn't try to escape anymore. I just kind of surrendered. And, you know, you don't think about the future. You think about living through the day because it's so violent. I mean, how can you think about next week? You can't.
Who were the people who were buying your services, the Johns?
Oh, they were married men from the suburbs, you know, most of them.
They didn't see any further into your situation that you were being held?
They didn't care that I was being held. You know, they just wanted to get their sexual gratification. You know, a lot of it is about power and control, too. You know, they get to buy a person. And once they pay, they feel they own you, and they can do anything they want. And, of course, they don't want to tell anybody that because they don't want people to look at them as this kind of person, as the kind of person that they are, actually. So, you know, people think that it's, you know, when you think about somebody like that, you think it would be somebody not described as a typical married suburban husband. But that pretty much is who it is.
How did you finally escape for good?
Actually, I was lucky other people weren't. There was a trick or a John or consumer, whatever you want to call him, that was killing women. He was killing prostituted women. There was one woman that I knew not that well, and then he killed another woman that I knew much better, and he got a third woman that was my pimp's brother's best friend. So he actually tortured that woman. She did live, but she kind of went crazy a little bit because he cut her and then had sex with her in the cut, and you know he hurt her for hours. Anyway, when that happened, the pimp that I had and his brother sent me and his brother's woman to Minnesota because they, of course, didn't want their meal ticket to be killed. And so when we went to Minnesota, she had a job right away. She got one over the phone, and I had an interview the next day. So I had the car. I went to pick her up from work, and there was a big picture window, and it was a flashy car. I pulled on the lights to look to see what was in the window, and the police pulled up. And they asked me for my ID. They told me that I had a warrant. I don't even remember what it was for. I think when I was young, I was drinking in the park once, and I lied about my age, so I think that's what it was for.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so they took me to jail, and the girl that I was there to pick up, they told the car she came to the jail to get the keys, but she didn't pay the $50 bond. And so it kind of made me angry that I, you know, made all that money for him and he wouldn't pay $50, because I'm sure he told her not to do it. She wouldn't have just left me there, I don't think. So I called a trick that I had in Chicago, and he wired the money, and they let me out of jail. And I went back, and I brought her the car and got my stuff, and I told her that I would meet her later, that I was going to go out on the street and make some money. And I never went back. When I got my stuff, I left. I left. I walked away, and I actually had to sleep on the street that night. I did meet a nice gentleman that let me sleep in an empty apartment, but I thought I was going to have to sleep on the street. And then I went to a hotel, and I only did it enough to pay my rent and eat. I just couldn't do it anymore. I didn't want to. I felt iffy doing it, and I wanted out, but there was nobody to help me.
Beth, what an incredible story. You now run an NGO in Arizona. That's where we're reaching you today. It's
yes.
called Willow Way. Tell us how the mission of Willow Way connects with your experience.
Well, I didn't have anyone to help me. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. And so that's the mission of Willow Way. It's to, if people want to get out, I can find them a resource. I can help them get out. You know, I can send them to housing programs or counseling or whatever it is that they need, you know, I'll be able to plug them in to make it much easier for them, because that wasn't available for me.
Mm-hmm. This happened, your story happened in the 1980s. How many girls were in similar situations and still are today?
Tons. When I first went out there, there were 30 women on a corner. I mean, there was lots and lots of people out there. And today it's happening just as much. I think it's happening even more because, you know, we have the hidden internet. You can post on the internet. Pimps can post on the internet and nobody knows.
Yeah.
You know, they can put young girls on and nobody knows. It's much easier to commit this crime now than it used to be,
Beth Jacobs, thank you again for sharing your story. Please stay on the line with us. We want to have a few other guests joining at this hour. Beth Jacobs is with us from Arizona, a human trafficking survivor, she is now running an organization called Willow Way that supports and empowers the victims of prostitution and sex trafficking. We want to have her join our conversation. Terry Hernandez, Executive Director of the Chrysalis Foundation, in our Des Moines studio, along with Lexi O'Connor, the founder of Teens Against Human Trafficking. Terry and Lexi, hello to you both.
Hi, Dan.
Let's talk to you first, Terry, about the event Monday and Tuesday that the Chrysalis Foundation is helping put on in Des Moines. What's happening?
Thanks, Ben. We're really proud to be bringing in another survivor with a story very similar to Beth, but she has some Iowa connections. Her name is Tina Front. She has created Courtney's House, which is another nonprofit that allows drop-in potential victims of trafficking. And Tina's coming to Des Moines for a series of events, but we kick it off with a luncheon on Monday at the Windsor Heights Community Center, where she'll be telling her story and sharing the information that will help us become much more aware of what's happening here in the state.
Mm-hmm. Why is awareness important? And this is a topic that if you describe what's happened and that it's not just an odd case that happens to Beth, but it happens all the time to many, many young women. Where does the awareness lead us in preventing this in the future?
Hopefully the awareness will be to recognize the signs of either potential victims or victims themselves. So Beth's story is very similar. Girls fall into this situation very innocently, trusting someone who shouldn't be trusted. And our hope is to prevent that from happening or for the public to begin to look for those signs and see young women like Beth who may look as though they're in an unusual situation. And rather than just thinking about it, they'll put a call in to 911 so something can be looked into.
Lexi O'Connor, you're founder of Teens Against Human Trafficking. When and why did you found this organization?
Yes, I did.
When did you do it? How old are you, may I ask?
I'm 17 years old. I'm
okay.
A junior.
Okay. What is your connection to human trafficking?
Yeah, so 2 years ago, I was at a national youth gathering with my youth group from church, and we had the opportunity to attend a seminar on an issue we wanted to learn something more about. So not knowing anything about human trafficking, I attended this trafficking seminar, and during it, I was absolutely appalled that this issue of modern-day slavery was plaguing the world that I lived in today, and I hadn't even known about it before. But what really affected me was when a woman who was sitting in the audience, she was from Atlanta, Georgia, I believe, and she stood up and she shared a story about girls that were discovered to be trafficked. And they were discovered because a police officer noticed a van parked at a gas station and there was a fluid coming out of the back of that van. And so he went up to the driver and he's like, "Hey, can I help you out? There's something wrong with your car." And the driver was being super shady and he's like, "You know what? Man, I got this. I'm going to leave. I'm going to see you later." And so the police officer was like, "You know what? I'm going to need to look into the back of your van. I need to know where this fluid's coming from." And he opened up the back of that van, and there were 12 little girls in there. Mm. And that fluid was their urine. And this this van was discovered at a Casey's gas station in Ames, Iowa. And this woman from Atlanta, Georgia, said to the room, she said, "If any of you are from Iowa, you have a problem in your state, and this isn't the only story. Something needs to be done about this." And so I was absolutely appalled that this was happening where I lived, at a gas station I've probably been to before. And so I went home and I started telling my friends, and as a group, we all didn't know about this, and we were frankly very angry about it because people just like us are being sold, and that's not okay. It's not fair that there are people that are being sold for their bodies, and we're allowed to be in school and out hanging out with our friends. That shouldn't be the way that it is today. And so we decided we wanted to do something about it.
What do you hope will be achieved by the event next week?
Mm-hmm. We hope that we can have a lot of awareness and more teenagers that can rise up and say, "You know what, we're not okay with this either. We want to start Teens Against Human Trafficking teams at our own schools, and we want to raise a lot of awareness about this so it can be stopped."
Lexi O'Connor, founder of Teens Against Human Trafficking, Terry Hernandez, executive director of the Chrysalis Foundation, with us. Also, Beth Jacobs joining us by phone, a human trafficking survivor. Also joining us now, our fourth guest, Lieutenant Kevin Kinney, is with the Investigative Division of the Johnson County Sheriff's Department. Lieutenant Kinney, welcome to our studio.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. You have been with the Sheriff's Department for almost 30 years. You're serving as a lieutenant in the Investigative Division now. You've received several awards, including a Crime Victim Service Award for your investigation into human trafficking, a ring, as a matter of fact, which was, as I understand it, one of the first federal prosecutions of human trafficking in the U.S. back in 2006. Would you recount that investigation? Give us a brief synopsis of what you discovered.
I discovered that there was a 12-year-old girl that was brought in from Minneapolis to the Eastern Iowa area, and that there was a group of individuals that were trafficking her. This group of individuals was involved in the drug trade also, in which they used the same underground networks a lot of times as they do with the human trafficking. This young girl was taken to Wellman, Iowa, where she was sold or given to individuals for drugs and later wound up working as a prostitute for DeMont Boy's father, Robert Salas, in Williamsburg, Iowa.
Mm-hmm. What were the challenges of cracking this ring, bringing it out, and having the evidence to convict those involved?
We ultimately had gotten the cooperation from Robert Salas's girlfriend, or the referred to as the bottom bitch. She's the one that's running the girls. And Robert Salas had beaten her severely, and she was fearful for her life. And one of the principals at the Clear Creek School District offered to introduce her to me, in which at that point we began an investigation talking with her working through the investigation at that point.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me, and I'm sure to many listeners, that this can happen in our society, in our towns here in Iowa, 13-year-old girl enslaved for sex without anybody taking notice, without somebody intervening. Explain how that happens, Lieutenant Kinney.
Well, they're trying to gratify themselves. They don't care that it's a young girl. Some of these people's fetishes are young girls. Many of these Johns that I had talked to that had had sex with this young girl stated they didn't realize she was that young, but her photographs and just looking at her, she was obviously very young. And no one came forward and said anything. Ultimately, the woman that was running the prostitution ring became suspicious and sent her back to Minnesota, and that's why she was beaten in the first place, is because Robert Sellis felt that his cash cow was gone, and she sent her back because she had a child that was relatively the same age.
Mm-hmm. We have to take a break, but where is Robert Sellis now?
He's in state prison in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. The then 12-year-old girl, where is she now?
She is in Minnesota. She has graduated college and has a child of her own now.
Okay. We want to talk more about human trafficking with our guests this hour. Lieutenant Kevin Kinney is with the Johnson County Sheriff's Department. Terry Hernandez of the Chrysalis Foundation, Lexi O'Connor of Teens Against Human Trafficking, and Beth Jacobs, a human trafficking survivor. We'll hear more instances. Hard to listen to these stories, but necessary in raising the awareness of what's happening right in our midst here. When we come back, we want to talk about a bill that's to be signed this afternoon by the governor to strengthen our laws against human trafficking. And also, we'll find out how we can spot human trafficking going on in our communities and what we can do about this. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about the painful subject of human trafficking, something that's been under the radar for many, many years, but is happening chiefly to many of the adolescent girls here in the Midwest as well. It's a worldwide problem. We're focusing on the Midwest this hour, talking with Beth Jacobs, a human trafficking survivor who now calls Arizona home. She runs an NGO there called the Willow Way, supports and empowers victims of prostitution and sex trafficking. Also talking with Terry Hernandez and Lexi O'Connor. They're involved with an event next week in Des Moines that will be raising awareness about human trafficking. Lieutenant Kevin Kinney with us as well. He's been for many years investigating human trafficking and has convictions under his belt to show and stories to show us how these cases can be cracked and how perhaps these human trafficking cases can be stemmed. Let's talk a little bit about the legislation that has made its way through the Iowa legislature, if we could. Earlier this month, the legislation aimed at strengthening penalties for human traffickers and providing aid to their victims landed on the governor's desk after winning approval, in fact, unanimous approval from the Iowa House and the Senate. And the bill to be signed this afternoon by the governor increases the penalty for pimping an underage prostitute from a Class D to a Class C felony, punishable by up to 10 years in prison. Also raises the penalty for purchasing the services of an underage prostitute from a misdemeanor to a felony. for the victims. It gives prosecutors discretion in handling prostitution cases involving minors, allowing, for instance, them to refer victims of human trafficking for social services rather than bringing criminal charges against them, and lengthens the statute of limitations on bringing charges against individuals who sexually abuse a minor. It also creates a human trafficking victim surcharge that can be levied on those found guilty of trafficking and directs money to a human trafficking victim fund that provides services to people forced into prostitution. Let me turn to you, Lieutenant Kinney. As I list off the highlights of that bill, do you see this as effective states steps towards stemming our problem?
I do.
What in particular there that I listed?
There are a number of things. By increasing the penalties, especially for the people that are buying the services, if they don't purchase the services, they're not going to want to there's going to be penalties for them to do that, and it's going to be a much more severe penalty. These people, when I had my first case, federal case, we didn't even have a state trafficking law. When we got that trafficking law, at least it gave us something we could turn to in the state system. Now, by strengthening that law, it's going to maybe deter some of these people from trafficking, especially these minor girls.
Mm-hmm. What about the side for the victims of this law, giving prosecutors more discretion? So, Beth, let me turn to you. You're in Arizona, but was it not the case that you thought if you went to law enforcement, you would wind up in jail?
Yes. In fact, they told me not only would I go to jail, they told me I should never tell anybody I was underage, because if they found out, if the police would take me to jail and if they found out I was underage, then I would also go into foster care and I would never be free again until I was 18, they said, if I was lucky. You know, they made it sound like such a horrific thing, and I was really afraid of them. I was afraid of the police, and foster care especially, because I didn't want that.
Lieutenant Kinney.
This is very true. In a number of my investigations, that is the same thing that is echoed by numerous girls, that these people are telling these girls that they're going to go to jail, they're going to go to foster care, they're not going to see their parents, their parents are going to be harmed, or they're going to be harmed if they talk to the police. And a lot of times it takes a very patient officer to sit there and try to connect with these girls.
The Polaris Project, it's an organization that works on all forms of human trafficking, classifies the states according to how effective they are in fighting human trafficking. Iowa has up to this point, actually in 2013, was ranked as a Tier 2 state out of four tiers, that Tier 1 being the best, meaning that Iowa has passed numerous laws that combat human trafficking but should take more steps to improve and implement its laws. Terry Hernandez, the bill signing this afternoon into a new law should improve Iowa's status there?
Yes, it should. We're really proud that the legislature is taking this up as an issue. We see it as a great start. Our hope is that the issue itself will become top of mind for all lawmakers, because the fund to support victim services is tremendously important. We know that breaking that traumatic bond that Beth was describing is something that takes a lot longer than any other type of service. So we know that the needs of those girls, once they leave the situation, are much greater.
Beth Jacobs, do you have an idea of how states are incrementally improving their laws across the nation now that we hear about Iowa's new law, this bill about to be signed by the governor?
You know, I think many states are—I think those report cards really helped. Shared Hope does a report card as well as Polaris Project, and that has encouraged states to really look at this issue. So I am so happy that happened, and thank you, Iowa. I'm glad you're doing that, because really the day that we do get out, that's the first day. You know, there is so much work to be done after that. You know, we have to figure out how to heal, and we have to figure out how to be functional. And a lot of things, one thing I do want to mention, too, I'm having issues even now, 30 years later, with my criminal background. So this is another area that we need to create laws in. The state of Arizona holds my background against me for 99 years, which is a life sentence, and that needs to be changed. I don't know what Iowa's is. I know Minnesota only holds it against you for 10 years. Each state is able to do that. So, you know, if your state has a long period of time, please get that changed because, you know, some states don't. There's only 14 states in our country that allow women or that allow girls to vacate their charges or get them expunged. And we need to make that be every state because, you know, this is something that happened to us. We are not prostitutes. We were prostituted. We were sex trafficked. I mean, I was a juvenile. And under our federal law, that mandates me as a sex trafficking victim. And even people who get in over the age of 18, some people get in when they're juveniles and they don't get out. I didn't get out till I was 22, but I didn't get an envelope in the mail when I turned 18 that said, hey, you have choices now. You know, we don't know about choices. When we're trafficked, the pimp keeps us as isolated as possible. So think about all that, you know, when you're helping a victim get out and helping her get herself together. There is so much to be done, and we have to make the laws able, you know, to let us rehabilitate ourselves.
Beth Jacobs is with us, a human trafficking survivor. Terry Hernandez of the Chrysalis Foundation, Lexi O'Connor of Teens, the founder of Teens Against Human Trafficking, and Lieutenant Kevin Kinney, who's investigated a number of these cases. And before we talk about warning signs and what how we identify human trafficking going on in our midst, Lieutenant Kinney, can you also tell us about a more recent case, the case of a Wisconsin man who 2 weeks ago was sentenced to life in prison for human trafficking, an investigation you were also involved in?
I had set up a human trafficking sting in Hills, Iowa. I did it in a small community. I found that it was much easier to have the girls come to a smaller community than, say, Iowa City. They felt safer there. When this girl came to our sting, she was identified as being a 15-year-old girl. She came forward, told us right away that we'd saved her. She had been picked up 9 days earlier in Milwaukee and forced to come to Iowa. There was a second girl that was with her that wound up being a 17-year-old girl. We were able to prosecute the person that had recruited them in Milwaukee, and he was given a life sentence.
Okay. Do you see the prosecutions, the investigations, and the prosecutions getting easier as awareness grows, as laws clamp down?
They're not getting easier because the internet, you can hide behind the internet a lot of times. People are becoming much more aware of what's going on. I now get tips from people calling me, hey, you might want to go check out so-and-so. There's something strange going on. Mm-hmm. I do feel that there's more awareness out there.
Let's talk about spotting warning signs, because now that those of us listening to this conversation are aware of a problem that perhaps we didn't realize before, what can we do about it? What should we be looking for? Let me start with you, Beth Jacobs. Do you have an idea of what the individual who has been up to this point blissfully unaware of this horrible problem can do?
Yeah, I mean, a few things. A change in behavior. If you notice a young person with a change in behavior, you know, they might have new clothes or unexplained resources that they didn't have before, or maybe hanging around with a lot of older people. I mean, people talking different, you know, using a lot of street lingo all of a sudden, or, you know, not having time to do some of the activities they used to do. You know, maybe not even talking to their friends as much as they used to do. You know, staying isolated more, not talking about what's happening with them. And some people just don't talk at all. They just kind of withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just look for a change in behavior, you know, more money, older people hanging around them, things like that.
Lexi O'Connor, what are you telling your peers can be done to prevent this?
Yeah, I'm just basically telling teens that we need to be aware of this because domestically the average age of entry is about 12 to 14 years old. And so it means that this is happening to people just like us and it's happening to teens and youth younger than us. And so we need to be aware that that this is happening to people like us. And so to be able to check the warning signs, know that maybe they're taking away, maybe they haven't been at school for so long. They don't want to talk to you about things anymore. Just being aware of the signs and knowing that statistically it could be happening in your area, it could be happening in your school.
Lieutenant Kinney, what do you have as far as what we can do as individuals here? It sounds like the typical scenario is a young teen is then invited to a party and then it goes from there.
I've had a number of different cases. One where two girls went to a party. They thought that they were going to go to Chicago with a couple of individuals. Once they got to Chicago, some people came out of a high-rise, took the girls into the apartment, the people that took them from Iowa City to Chicago, then left. They never seen them again, and then they were forced into a sex trafficking ring. There are individuals that, I know through investigations that are coming approximately four hours out from the major cities. Iowa City kind of sits in the middle of St. Louis, Minneapolis, Chicago, Milwaukee. They'll come out here. They're trying to find girls that are runaway girls. They're recruiting in our Ped Mall here at the university, or in Iowa City, downtown Iowa City, where young kids were coming to be with the university students. And these guys are trying to talk them into going someplace, taking care of them. They're just trying to coerce them into town or back into the city, where they are taken out of their element, and they don't know where to turn once they are taken there. There are other people that are coming here to Iowa to sell these girls, because through our investigations, we're finding out that the people in eastern Iowa will pay more for a prostitute than they will, say, in Chicago. So that's why these people are bringing these girls back to the rural communities.
Mm-hmm. Is that, in your opinion, is that where really we can make a difference, is to enact laws that clamp down on the people who want these services?
If you cut off the demand, you're going to take care of a lot of this problem, I feel.
And how do you do that?
You're going to have to go after the Johns and prosecute the people that are wanting these services.
Mm-hmm. Beth Jacobs, we associate human trafficking and this type of underage prostitution often with truck stops. You work with a lot of young women. Is that still the case? Are truck stops centers for this?
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, transients, I mean, trucks are coming and going everywhere. So it is very easy to hide what's happening there, you know. And they actually call prostituted women or sex trafficking victims lizard lots. You know, that's the term they call them. Or lot lizards. I'm sorry. I said
Lot lizards?
Lot lizards, yes. So we're dehumanized even more at the truck stops. I mean, that's where I was turned out. That's what happened to me. My entrance into prostitution and trafficking happened there. And there were other trucks there. I mean, it wasn't like we were the only two people at that gas station. And nobody, I'm sure somebody heard something. Nobody helped me. Nobody said a word. So, you know, that just validated what the pimp told me even more, that nobody cares about me. Nobody cares what happens. Because it happened in the public and nobody did care. You know, and I think, you know, people say to themselves, and we do need to be aware of this. This needs to be something that we talk about. Because if we don't talk to our kids and warn our kids about that, you can believe the pimps are telling them about it. You know, I think by not talking about it and not educating our children, we're actually hurting them. We're putting them more at risk. Because as everyone here has said, the internet is like the superhighway for trafficking.
I wanted to go to Lexi O'Connor quickly here, too, as a 17-year-old. That's what you're encouraging parents and teens to have these conversations, Lexi?
Yeah, I think it's very important because as human beings, we're really kind of afraid to get into each other's business. And so if we're willing to open up people's eyes and say, hey, this is going on. If you see something, you need to say something because that's how it stopped. That's going to be the way to end this. We're just afraid to say anything.
Mm-hmm. Lieutenant Kinney, you on the truck stops issue there, your investigations revolve often around business at truck stops?
I haven't had a lot of interaction with the truck stops. We don't have any large truck stops here. I do know what's happening.
In Johnson County.
I do know what's happening at the truck stops, and I do know that there are officers that are looking for different things that do happen there.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to you, Terry Hernandez. We haven't heard from you for a few minutes, and we're ending the hour here. What thoughts, what insights do you have that haven't been raised yet that you want to bring out?
I think that it's so important for parents to have some awareness about what their daughters and sons are doing. The internet, as was mentioned, is really a terrible threat because people can be anonymous. Predators can get on the internet, make friends with young women, and portray themselves as something that they're not and lure them into a situation that turns out to be much like what Beth's situation is. I also think that for us in our work at Chrysalis with young girls, adolescent girls especially, is to help them have a better sense of themselves, because what we also know about young women who are occasionally or more often solicited into trafficking, many of them have abuse issues at home. Many of them have been runaways, and they become much higher risk for traffickers the more often that that happens. Most often, a runaway within about 48 hours will be approached for either prostitution or to be trafficked. So,
what if our awareness is raised? What do we do with that awareness, Lieutenant Kinney? If we think something is suspicious going on in our downtown somewhere, but we're always sort of reticent about saying anything because we might be wrong, right? What should we think? What is our mindset when we say there's something not right about that young girl with that older man?
If you think that there is something wrong, there probably is, and you should contact the local police and report this. I would much rather go out and find out that there was nothing wrong than some young lady that has been forced to do something that she does not want to be doing or has been kidnapped.
Mm-hmm. Beth Jacobs, you second that?
Yes, I second that. I mean, if someone would have stepped in and helped me, it could have been prevented.
Yeah. Okay, Beth Jacobs, thank you very much for joining us from Arizona, human trafficking survivor. We heard your story in the first half hour. If you didn't catch it, this is a podcast to listen to that. Beth now runs an NGO in Arizona called Willow Way that supports and empowers victims of prostitution and sex trafficking. Beth, thank you for telling your story and for raising our awareness here in the Midwest.
And thank you for having me, and thank you for educating people. I appreciate that more than you know.
Terry Hernandez, thank you, of the Chrysalis Foundation, where you are executive director. Lexi O'Connor, involved with the Chrysalis Foundation in this event next week, founders of Teens Against Human Trafficking. Tell us how we can find out more about this event.
You can go to the Chrysalis website to learn. There are several events, Ben. There is a luncheon on Monday. There is a workshop on Tuesday. Lexi is putting together a forum in Ankeny at the Ankeny High School on Wednesday evening. We've got a lot of other community partners. Junior League of Des Moines is hosting an event. Drake University is hosting an event. So go to our website. You can find that information about any or all of these events, so you'll have a chance to hear more about this issue.
Lieutenant Kevin Kinney, thank you for coming into our studio in Iowa City with the Investigation Division of the Johnson County Sheriff's Department. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's close the hour with some songwriting from award-winning Ankeny singer-songwriter Mary McAdams. Was moved to write a song about human trafficking after hearing an interview about human trafficking we did a couple years ago on Iowa Public Radio. Let's end this edition of River to River with a song by Mary McAdams, performed by her as well. It's called Girl Next Door. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
She leaves. it's done, she curls up on the closet floor. She's a stolen child, she's the girl.